you like to call him?
Rosa asked, unable to take her eyes off him as he sucked greedily at her breast. She was blooming, her cheeks pink and her short hair lustrous. Dimitri had been worried that neither of them would know what to do with the baby, but straight away Rosa seemed to have an instinct for motherhood. She was so calm that the child stopped crying the instant he was snuggled in her arms.
I like the name Nicholas, he said. How about you? Nicholas is lovely, she cried. Do you mean after your Tsar?
No, our Tsar was a fool. I just like the way the syllables fall from the tongue. Nicholas. Rosa had found a crib for the boy and arranged his things in the corner of their bedroom. She sang as she rocked him to sleep, or changed his nappy, or played with him on the rug. It was obvious she was happy. She had given up asking Dimitri to marry her, but only insisted that he buy her a ring so that people thought them married, and to that he consented. After the birth, he had planned to take his typewriter to a cafe on the corner to work without interruption, but found that he liked being at home, with the babble of their voices in the next room and the smell of his lunch bubbling on the stove. Rosa was careful not to disturb him while he was working. As well as continuing to write articles for Rule, he had started a new novel. Like his first novel, Exile had elements of autobiography. The main character was haunted by a terrible act he had committed in his past, before being banished from his homeland and living a shadowy half-life, unable to forget. Dimitri analyzed the experience of being a stranger in a foreign land, with a culture quite different from his own, and concluded that in many ways it was liberating. In Berlin, he could reinvent himself outside the strict rules of Russian society. Had his father been alive, he would never have been able to become a writer. He would have been expected to pursue a military career all the way to the top, amassing medals as he went. And yet he still felt a sense of dislocation, as though he was leading someone else's life. Not being fluent in German annoyed him. Somehow he couldn't get to grips with the staccato rhythms of the language. And his relationship with Rosa still felt temporary. She was someone to keep him company until Tatiana returned. Even with the baby, he couldn't shake that feeling, although he knew it was unfair to Rosa. He had no complaints about her. In many ways, she was the perfect wife, cheerful, affectionate, and forgiving. She asked little of him, a roof over their heads, money for food, and not much else. When her mother and sister visited, he was polite and welcoming, although their disapproval of him was visceral. "Why do you love me?" he asked Rosa once. He genuinely couldn't understand it.
"Because you need me," she replied. "Because I want to try and make you happy."
"It won't work," he told her. "Melancholy is the condition of the Russian soul." And yet, Rosa could make him laugh, almost against his will. When she returned from the daily shopping trip, she usually had a vignette of some tiny incident with which to entertain him. A housewife scrubbing her front steps with vigor, then a bird defecating on them with a huge splat just as she turned to go indoors. A bad-tempered tram conductor who was unaware someone had stuck a notice on his back saying, "I've not had a bath since 1917. They no longer went out in the evenings, because they could not afford a Kinderhüter, never mind the cost of alcohol in the cafes and nightclubs, but Dimitri would pour himself a vodka at home. Sometimes they invited friends for supper, but mostly they read books or listened to the radio. He was not unhappy. At night, they often made love. Rosa had a remarkable enthusiasm for sex and a talent for arousing him even when he felt exhausted. Cool fingers, the touch of her lips, her luscious breasts pressed against him, all had a miraculous effect on his libido. She had assured him that it would be impossible for her to get pregnant again while she was breastfeeding little Nicholas, so they were both astonished to find, when the baby was just 7 months old, that she was wrong about that. Their doctor confirmed another was due the following year.
"Wouldn't it be lovely if we had a bigger apartment where the children could have their own room?"
Rosa sighed. She didn't nag, never nagged, but he knew it was a reasonable request. He asked his publisher for an advance against the next novel, and managed to pay the deposit on a two-bedroom apartment not far away, where they moved just before a little girl was born in the summer of 1926.
"Can I call her Marta?" Rosa pleaded. "I always wanted a daughter called Marta." "Of course,"
Dmitri replied, his voice a little husky. Marta is a pretty name.
The strength of his feelings when he looked at his baby daughter amazed him. A combination of protectiveness and sheer awe at her innate femininity. Even as a newborn, she held her hands daintily like a ballerina and gazed up at him with innocent adoration. How could they have created someone quite so beautiful? Sometimes he almost fancied she looked like Tatiana, although that was, of course, impossible.
Hello, little girl,
he whispered, and she clutched his finger in a surprisingly strong fist. Nicholas had begun to crawl and annoyed him by grabbing at his papers, knocking over cups, falling down and wailing, even though he could not possibly be hurt. Secretly, Dmitri admitted to himself that he loved his daughter more. Nicholas was clumsy and needful of attention, reminding Dmitri of himself as a child, while Marta seemed graceful and sure of herself, completely unlike him. When he said anything of the sort to Rosa, she laughed and chided him.
They're babies! You can't possibly judge their characters yet.
In summer 1927, Exile was published, and it proved rather more controversial than Interminable Love, with much debate over Dmitri's views of life in exile. The discussion was taken up by the German press when it was published in translation, resulting in many more sales. The book was reprinted, and for once, they had a little money to spare. Dmitri gave Rosa cash to buy new clothes for herself and the children, and one summer's day they took a day trip to the countryside with a picnic that Rosa had carefully packed in a wicker basket. Watching the children playing on the grass, completely caught up in the moment, and watching Rosa hum as she cut big hunks of bread and cheese to serve with beer and sausage, Dmitri felt the closest he ever came to happiness. He examined the sensation, suspicious of it, feeling he did not deserve it. What about Tatiana? What about the way he had let her down? Rosa handed him his food, then leapt to her feet, tucked one child under each arm, and began to spin them round and round. Nicholas and Marta shrieked and chortled from deep in their bellies, and suddenly Dmitri found himself laughing too. It was still an unfamiliar sensation for him, but it got easier every time. On the way back on the train, as the children slept on their laps, Rosa asked him a question that had obviously been on her mind.
Would you go back to Russia if the communists were overthrown?
He frowned. It's not going to happen in my lifetime. They are too firmly entrenched. He realized from her disappointed expression that this wasn't the answer she wanted.
But if they were to fall, what would happen to me and your children?
Rosa, I will always look after you. I promise.
You have nothing to fear.
She was playing with the ring on her wedding finger, about to say more, but instead she turned with an almost imperceptible sigh to look out of the window. Suddenly Dmitri saw the situation from her point of view, and realized he was treating her appallingly. She loved him. She had borne him two children, and still he was not committing himself to her. It wasn't fair. Wherever I go, you three will come with me. You are my family, he said, and meant it. Rosa grinned and leaned over to kiss him, carefully, without waking the babes. Deep down, Dmitri felt uneasy. What if Tatiana came back? But then a voice said, what if she doesn't? He had made a life, albeit by default rather than choice. And now, he must stick with it.
Chapter 46. Lake Akanabi, New York State, the 1st of October 2016. The 30th of September was warm and sunny, but a cold front swept in overnight, and Kitty woke to a chilly, overcast morning on the 1st of October, almost as if the weather was following the calendar. She thought she had been pretty thorough with her repairs, but drafts mysteriously found their way in, making it hard to warm up when she came out of the cold shower. How had Dmitri survived here in winter? He must have been very hardy. Did Rosa stay with him? Did the children visit? She had found out a few things about his life in Berlin, but virtually nothing about what they did in America. apart from the date of their arrival, June 1934. Kitty had to go to Indian Lake for food, and on the way, she stopped at the Vacation Park coffee house.
"Only 2 weeks until we close for winter," Jeff told her. "You're my first customer today, and I don't expect there will be many more."
"I'm only here till the 14th, Kitty told him, "but I'll be back next year. When do you open again?"
"Easter. It can still be snowing, but we get some hardy souls who venture out."
Kitty plugged in her laptop and sipped her coffee. She had hit a brick wall researching Dimitri, so she decided to see what she could find about Rosa Lieberman through her genealogy site. Straight away, she found that she had lived in the Albany area after her arrival in the US, that she served on the Parent Teacher Association at the high school and volunteered at the hospital. Her mother and sister had come over from Germany in 1936 and lived nearby. She supposed that Dimitri and Rosa must have discovered Lake Akanabi while living in Albany. Were they outdoorsy types? She remembered Bob saying that he had never seen anyone with Dimitri, no woman, no children, and there was the mystery about why no one had been able to contact the children when he died. Had they divorced and the children took their mother's side? Kitty searched, but could find no record of a divorce. It was easier to find information about her great-uncle Nicholas, who had moved to California at the age of 30 and got work at a winery in Sonoma Valley. He'd married a Californian girl, but they didn't have any children, and she was shocked to read that he died in 1970, before Kitty was born. He'd only been 45 years old. Kitty vaguely remembered Grandma Marta saying how close they had been as children and how much she missed him when he was gone. They used to have little chats when Marta came to stay over to let Kitty's mum and dad go out for the evening. Kitty would crawl into her grandmother's bed in the morning, smelling the familiar old lady smell of talcum powder and gawping at her teeth in the glass by the bed. Marta had moved to Britain in the late 50s, and Kitty assumed she had come for love because she married a Sheffield businessman. Kitty's mum, Elizabeth, had been born in 1960, an only child, and had Kitty in 1981. So the family was geographically spread out, but she couldn't understand why the police had been unable to find any of them when Dimitri died in 1986. Didn't he have an address book, for goodness sake? Kitty asked Jeff for another coffee and opened her email folder. The usual rush of messages popped up one after another. Tom, Tom, friends, spam, Tom, Amber, Tom, Random House, New York. Kitty clicked to open the Random House message.
"Dear Miss Fisher, I'm afraid there are no editors remaining here who knew your great-grandfather, Dmitry Yakovlevich, but I can see from the historical accounts that he was a much-valued, very successful Knopf author from the 1930s through to the 1970s. My intern found some of his old manuscripts in our archives and, if you would like to have them, we'd be happy to send them on. I haven't read any of his works yet, but plan to have a look at In the Pale Light of Dawn and Toward the Sunset as soon as I can find the time. I warn you that there is not much demand for reprints of 1940s novels unless there are special circumstances, but I will approach them with an open mind. Many thanks for getting in touch. All best wishes, Rebecca Wicks."
It was nice to feel that Dimitri's work was appreciated, even though his contemporaries had moved on. She would like to see those manuscripts, but couldn't decide where to have them sent. She could give the address in London's Crouch End, but what if she never lived there again? A tight band of panic encircled her chest as she thought about renting a flat, getting a job, and starting her adult life from scratch. That wasn't what she wanted. Suddenly, she began to type an email to Tom, the words flowing, fingers dashing across the keyboard. "Dear Tom, I have read and considered your letter, but have to tell you that the last thing in the world I want to do is to sit in a dingy consulting room with some smarmy counsellor telling us what's wrong with our relationship. You knew when you married me that I tend to avoid emotional confrontation. It's part of who I am, and I am not about to change. Anyway, how did this come to be about my shortcomings? You were the one who committed the marital faux pas of dipping your pen in another woman's inkwell. I'd like to throw this discussion right back at you and ask first of all whether you want an open marriage. If you don't, how can you convince me that you would never do this again?
either with Miss Karen Bayliss or some other woman. What if you miss out on a promotion at another job? What if you even get sacked? I don't know how this works, but perhaps you have concocted some plan in your therapy sessions. Please spare me the counsellor speak in your reply. I will be back in London in a couple of weeks, and I suppose we should meet to talk. I don't feel quite ready to see you yet, but... She stopped. This email was all wrong. She didn't feel angry with Tom anymore. It felt as though there had to be some kind of reprimand in her first communication. But not like this. When she thought about seeing him, she knew she would want to run straight into his arms. She was dying to sit down and chat to him, properly chat, like they used to do in the old days. There was so much to tell him. But where should she start? She saved the email into her drafts folder and decided to return to it later, perhaps on the way back from the shops. At the supermarket, she picked up another crate of Chardonnay. The checkout girl didn't comment anymore, just scanned it through with tight lips. On the drive home, the white wine was calling out to Kitty. She needed a dose of liquid anaesthetic, so she drove straight to the cabin, took her shopping indoors, and opened the bottle. She felt better already when she heard the glug-glug sound of the golden liquid swirling around her favourite glass. Over the lake, the sunset seemed more vivid than ever, like some kind of exaggerated hyper-reality. She sat on the jetty to watch, listening to the birds and frogs winding down like clockwork toys with the fading of the light. She felt entirely present in the moment, but somehow it was as though she was a visitor in someone else's life, Dimitri's maybe, rather than a protagonist in her own.
Chapter 47. Berlin, 1930. One day Rosa brought home a women's magazine called Das Blatt der Hausfrau with an article about the many people scattered around Europe who claimed to be missing Romanovs. There were dozens of them now, but the magazine profiled the main contenders with photographs of several. Dimitri had heard that there were such folk, but none of their stories had sounded convincing enough for him to pursue. Now that Rosa opened the magazine in front of him with a quizzical look, he stopped to look, pausing over the German text. Michel Ange, who claimed to be Tatiana, was said to have escaped Russia via Siberia in 1925 and arrived in Paris, where she took a small apartment. After she wrote to Tsar Nicholas's mother in Denmark, saying that she was preparing to come and visit, she was shot dead in her apartment, friends blaming the Bolshevik secret police. Dmitri did not doubt that the Cheka had killed her, but looking at the photograph, she was plainly not Tatiana. The face was broader, the chin more pointed, the eyes not so intelligent. Marga Boots claimed that Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany himself had recognized her as Olga when she arrived in that country after a long journey through eastern Russia and China. She gave interviews to many journalists about the brave Red Guardsman who rescued her from the Ipatiev house, but the story was laughable since she did not even slightly resemble Olga. Nadezhda Vasilyeva had been arrested in 1920 trying to escape from Siberia into China, and was now being held in an insane asylum in the USSR, from which she wrote regular letters to monarchs around Europe proclaiming herself to be Anastasia. She had an angular face and looked much older than Anastasia would have been, so Dmitri moved on. Eugene Nikolaevich Ivanov, who lived with the parish priest in Poland, claimed to be Alexei and explained that an old Cossack had helped him escape from Russia. Dmitri paused over this story because the photograph did look similar to Alexei, and it seemed he suffered from haemophilia, unlike most other Alexei claimants. Could it be? Should he travel to Poland to meet him? He couldn't help thinking it would be a wasted journey. Somehow the story didn't quite add up. The article made Dmitri wonder what Tatiana could do to make herself known if she ever managed to find her way out of Russia. She would most likely go to one of her relatives, but what if they failed to recognize her, or weren't sure? She wouldn't know where to look for him, but he was certain that 12 years on he would recognize her in an instant. She would be 33 years old now. She might have wrinkles at the corners of her eyes, and perhaps her hair would have streaks of grey. Would her slender figure have thickened? No matter. He would know her anywhere. Thinking about her brought on a weight of sadness, and he turned to stare out the window. Rosa brought a cup of coffee and sat beside him, her hand on his arm. "Why do people pretend to be Romanovs?"
she asked. Does it make them feel important? Do they hope one day to sit on the throne of Russia? Dmitri shrugged. There is talk that Tsar Nicholas kept vast amounts of money in overseas banks, and a successful claimant could access those funds. There are many reasons to try, but in truth, they all seem poor creatures who struggle with their sanity. Rosa squeezed his leg. It must be hard for you. But I brought the magazine because I thought you might like to see. Did I do the right thing? It's fine. He shook his head, as if to dispel the memory. Nicholas and Marta were sitting on the floor playing at being shopkeepers. Nicholas put a single potato into Marta's basket and said,
That will be 20 marks, and I'm not giving you any more because you don't even like potatoes.
Marta handed back the potato, saying,
It is too expensive. I think I will shop elsewhere today.
Dmitri and Rosa laughed, but it was a sensitive point. The German economy was once again in trouble. The Great Depression that hit America the previous year had caused mass unemployment and business failures around the globe. Every street corner in Berlin had a woman in rags begging for a pfennig or two to feed her children. Men got up at dawn to queue for poorly paid labouring jobs. Dmitri still earned just enough from his articles for Rule, plus royalties on his books to pay for their food and cover the rent, but there was no surplus, and he knew Rosa haggled with the best of them when she shopped for food. All the same, it was bittersweet to hear their 4-year-old daughter doing the same. For someone who worked as a journalist, Dmitri mused, he had twice failed to spot emerging political apocalypse until it became unmissable. In Russia, he had been aware of the grumblings against the monarchy, and knew that revolution was in the air, but the November coup led by Lenin and Trotsky had seemed to him to emerge from nowhere. Similarly, in Berlin, he was aware that men in brown shirts, known as the Sturmabteilung, were stirring up street brawls, and that they attacked anyone who did not support a minor fringe party known as the National Socialists, but he was astonished when that same minority party won 18% of the vote in the 1930 elections. Burtsev asked him to write an article for Ruhl about the National Socialists' claim that communism was part of an international Jewish conspiracy, and Dmitri had no trouble at all in rubbishing that notion. In Russia, the grassroots Bolshevik movement had gained strength from the disgruntled poor of all religions. Trotsky might have been Jewish, but Lenin and the new leader, Stalin, were not. Who was supposed to be organizing this Jewish conspiracy? None of it made sense, and he was scathing in his critique. Rosa was worried when she read his article.
Perhaps it would be better not to draw attention to ourselves. It leaves you open to accusations of bias, since I am Jewish.
Dmitri had never given a thought to Rosa's religion, because she did not practice, and their children were not being raised in any particular faith. He had long since decided that organized religion was an absurdity, and she agreed with him.
I can't temper my journalistic opinions because of our personal circumstances, he replied.
Someone needs to stand up and point out the dangers of this new creed. Rosa was worried, though.
Adolf Hitler is rapidly gaining supporters because he is restoring German pride. He needs scapegoats to blame for the economic ills, and Jews and communists are easy targets.
That's ridiculous. He looks Jewish himself. There might be a few unscrupulous Jewish moneylenders, but he can't blame an entire race. Dmitri soon realized how short-sighted he was being as the political landscape mutated rapidly and street fights turned some districts of Berlin into battle zones. Brown-shirted Sturmabteilung and the so-called Hitler Youth, young boys in Lederhosen spouting the party message on purity of race, were suddenly everywhere. The neighbors' sons, who had previously seemed nice young men, mutated into snarling bullies full of hatred. Dmitri did not realize that Rosa had become a target of this vitriol until their son Nicholas asked him over dinner one evening,
Papa, what is a hura?
Rosa tutted and tried to hush him, her face flushing. Where did you hear that word? Dmitri demanded.
Mama said it to Mrs. Brandt.
Rosa shook her head and motioned to Dmitri that she would tell him about it later, before saying,
Mama was wrong to use that word, and you must forget about it and never repeat it.
Later she told Dmitri that Mrs. Brandt had spat in her face and called her a filthy Jew as she walked home from the butcher's holding the children by the hands.
I lost my temper, she said, and yelled, at least my mother wasn't a hura. And then I remembered the children and their big ears.
How does she know you are Jewish? Dmitri asked. Rosa used his surname, Yakovlevich, and her dark looks were more southern European than Jewish. She shrugged.
I don't know. People talk. My sister has lost her job, and she is sure it's because she is Jewish, although her employer didn't say as much.
You must tell me if it happens again, Dmitri insisted. I will not stand for this.
The thought of Rosa being subjected to such treatment was painful to him. She was a good person who never harmed a soul. On the contrary, she went out of her way to help others. She collected shopping for an elderly neighbour who could no longer walk, and she often looked after a friend's children so she could work, going to her apartment so as not to disturb Dmitri. But one Sunday afternoon, when Dmitri took the family to the zoo, he became intensely aware of whispering and pointing in their direction. Rosa ignored it, and the children were only interested in seeing Sammy, the giant sea elephant, at feeding time. As the day went on, Dmitri's temper became increasingly frayed, so when a man approached and said to Rosa, "Your sort shouldn't be allowed in here," Dmitri pulled back his fist and punched him hard in the face. There was a cracking sound and blood spurted. The children began to cry, and he knew he should not have done it, but at the same time he was glad to take action, proud that at the age of almost 40 he could still produce a punch like that. Rosa bustled them away before there were any repercussions.
"It doesn't help," she whispered. "I found it's best to ignore them."
But Dmitri couldn't ignore this new movement that had turned his peace-loving girlfriend into a social pariah. It made him sick to his stomach, and he decided to take a writer's revenge by writing a novel about it. Ostensibly, it would be about the rise of Bolshevism within one particular village in Russia, and the way it affected ordinary villagers who had previously lived together in harmony. But actually, it was about what was happening on the German national stage. As he wrote, the ideas flowed, and he could feel in his fingertips that this was going to be the most important book he would ever write. He wanted it to have a mythical quality, but at the same time show readers the lunacies of a system that favours one racial group above another. His novel was published in February 1933, just 2 weeks after Hitler was appointed Chancellor, with the title The Boot That Kicked, an obvious allusion to the jackboots worn by the Sturmabteilung. Several newspapers interviewed Dmitri, and publicly he always maintained that it was about the rise of Bolshevism in Russia rather than Nazism in Germany, but he added that if people wished to draw parallels, that was their prerogative. Almost overnight, the level of harassment Rosa experienced in their street increased until she was afraid to go out of doors. She sent Dmitri to buy food, and if she took the children out for some fresh air in the park, Dmitri had to accompany them. He wasn't a particularly tall man, but he had learned how to handle himself during his Imperial Guard training. In response to taunts, he squared up and stared the perpetrator directly in the eye in a way that left no doubt he was ready for a fight, and they invariably backed down.
"We can't live like this. Perhaps we should go to stay near my mother in the country," Rosa suggested.
"It will happen in the countryside as well," Dmitri argued gloomily. "Mein Führer is encouraging anti-Semitism, and everyone wants to curry favour." One evening, they returned from a day out to find the front door of their apartment smashed in. They looked inside to see a chaos of destruction. Pages had been ripped from Dmitri's books and scattered like dead leaves on the floor. Clothes were strewn around, and a bag of flour had been emptied over them. Limbs had been torn from Nicholas's toy animals and Marta's dolls. Dmitri's typewriter had been smashed to pieces, and his reporter's notebook stolen. Cups and plates were broken, furniture overturned. Dmitri rushed to the bedroom, and was relieved to find that they had not opened the brown leather suitcase in which he kept Tatiana's diary. He couldn't bear anything to happen to that. When he returned to the front room, the children were in tears, and Rosa had sunk to her knees to comfort them.
"Who did this?"
Marta lisped through her tears, and Rosa hugged her before replying,
"Bad people."
Nicholas's lip trembled. Dmitri looked at the three of them huddled together in the midst of the carnage, and felt a wave of primal emotion. He couldn't bear for his family to be upset, couldn't stand them being hurt.
and he realized that, although he still clung to the memory of the exquisite love he had experienced with Tatiana, this feeling was just as true a kind of love. He would lay down his life to protect these three souls. The atmosphere in Berlin, of whispering and bullying, mistrust and betrayal, reminded him powerfully of St. Petersburg in 1917. Back then he had been too slow to react. If he had arranged to have the Romanovs rescued when they were under house arrest in St. Petersburg, just a few hundred miles from the safety of Denmark, they would be alive today. Instead, he had hesitated, with tragic consequences. This time he was determined he wouldn't delay. Later, when the children were asleep, he said to Rosa, "We have to leave Germany until this madness is over." She looked sad.
"But where would we go? This is our home."
"We both speak good English, so it makes sense to go to an English-speaking country. I won't go to Britain because I can't forgive them for abandoning the Romanovs. How about America?" Rosa was astounded.
"It's so far. When would I see my family, my mother and sister?"
Frankly, Dmitri didn't much care if he never saw her mother and sister again, but he offered,
"They could come too, if you like." "Would America accept us? How do you go about applying?"
"I'll ask at the consulate tomorrow. I can't have my family subjected to this." He took her face in his hands.
"There's something I've never said to you before, Rosa. I want you to know that I do love you. You and the children mean the world to me."
She gasped, and the joy that shone from her eyes made him feel guilty that he had never said it before. They had been lovers for 11 years, had created 2 children together, and he had made her wait all this time to hear the words she yearned for. He didn't deserve a woman as patient and good as her, but he was determined somehow to become worthy of her love.
Chapter 48. Lake Aconabee, New York State, the 4th of October 2016. With only 10 days to go before she had to leave the States, Kitty drove to Gloversville to collect Tatiana's notebook from Vera and to return the books about the Romanovs she had borrowed. Over a cup of coffee, she shared the information she had gleaned about Dmitri's life after he left Russia. "I assume he went to Berlin because it was a meeting point for white Russians after the Civil War. He met his wife Rosa, and they had 2 children. But perhaps they left in 1934 to escape the Nazis, because Rosa was Jewish. Dmitri would have been 48 when the Second World War began, so wouldn't have been called up to fight. But I have no idea how he earned a living, or why he only wrote 2 more novels after coming to America." She took a bite of the home-baked cookie Vera had put on a plate beside her. It was gooey with peanut butter. Vera couldn't help. "You assume in this day and age that you can find anything you want to know on the Internet, but it's simply not true." "Are you working on anything interesting now?" Kitty's mouth was gummed up with peanut butter, making her words sound indistinct. "I'm translating a novel from Russian. It's very gloomy, although with undoubted literary merit. The characters endlessly analyze their motivations till you want to shout, 'Get on with it, buddy!'" Kitty smiled in recognition. "Yes, the same is true of Dmitri's novels. His characters are incapacitated by guilt, except in his anti-fascist novel, The Boot That Kicked, when they are energized by fury. I rather like the introspection. I wish more men were introspective." Of course, that's what Tom was doing with his counselor, trying to understand what made him tick. Kitty admired him for the effort. It couldn't be easy. On the way back to the cabin, she stopped at the hardware store in Indian Lake to ask the owner's advice on winterproofing her cabin. Now she had spent so much time and effort on repairs, she didn't want to arrive next spring to find it had fallen apart again. "You've applied the weatherproof varnish," he said, frowning in concentration, "and it's not leaking anywhere."
"Nope."
"You could fit some shutters or board over the windows," he suggested. "Do the eaves have enough overhang so that water from the roof runs off clear off the walls?" Kitty nodded. "A good 6 inches. "And what's drainage like around the cabin? You want to avoid water pooling round the foundations." She frowned.
"Actually, there is an area to the side where a puddle forms after heavy rain. What should I do about it?"
"Easy.
dig a trench to let it run off.
That made sense. Kitty thanked him and headed back to the cabin to start digging. With the edge of her spade, she marked out a channel that led from the hollow of the puddle down towards the lakeshore some 15 feet away. The ground was mushy from the rain of a few days earlier, and her spade cut cleanly through, only snagging on tree roots and mossy undergrowth. She would miss Lake Akanabi. Maybe I'll bring Tom here in the spring, she thought, then added mentally, all being well. She'd like to show him this magical place. Perhaps they could hire a boat and explore the coves. Did that mean she had forgiven him? She never thought about Karen Bayliss now, so she supposed she had. All of a sudden, her spade hit something hard. She assumed it was a rock and tried to dig around it, but a foot along, the hard object was still there, about 3 feet below the surface. She cleared some of the earth above it and realized her spade was hitting a wooden crate that was about 2 feet wide. Had Dimitri buried it? Perhaps it was a treasure chest containing family heirlooms. Kitty was excited, wondering if she was about to solve the mystery of her great-grandfather's later life. She kept digging along the line of the box, which was longer than she had expected. It lay on a slope, so she had to remove more soil at the upper part than the lower. When she had worked about 6 feet along, there was a cracking sound as her spade pierced an area of rotten wood. She used the blade as a lever to prise open a corner of the box and bent to peer in. There was something yellowy-white, round. Suddenly, a scream burst from her lungs as she realized there was a human skull staring up at her. She'd uncovered a coffin. Kitty ran indoors, irrationally terrified, as if the skeleton might be pursuing her. Her voice was trembling as she dialed the number of the police station and told them of her grisly discovery.
"Someone will be there within the hour," she was told. "Don't touch anything in the meantime."
Kitty couldn't face waiting on her own for an hour with a dead body outside. She rang Bob's cell phone, told him what she had found, and asked if he could please come over to wait with her.
"Be right there," he said. "Pour yourself a stiff drink."
She took his advice and poured a glass of Chardonnay, then stayed indoors, her heart pounding, until she heard Bob's outboard approaching the jetty 10 minutes later.
"It's over there,"
she gestured from the porch, and as soon as he tied up the boat, he went to have a look.
"Well, I'll be damned," he called. "Cossack could have been there for decades. Maybe it dates from before Dimitri's time."
"I hope so. I hope we're not about to find out my great-granddad was a murderer."
Kitty tried to speak lightly, but she felt choked with worry. Had someone from Dimitri's past caught up with him? Had there been a fight that went too far and he was forced to hide the evidence? When the police arrived, they tied plastic ribbon around the area and erected a tent over the coffin. She and Bob sat on the jetty drinking wine and watching as a forensics team arrived and pulled protective suits over their clothes.
"You're probably not going to be able to stay here while they investigate," Bob said. "You're welcome to our guest room."
He gestured to his house on the other side of the water. "Thanks, but I'll probably stay at the vacation park. I expect they'll give me a deal this late in the season." It would feel spooky to sleep in the cabin, even after the coffin had been taken away. That skull would haunt her dreams. An officer came to take her statement and get her cell phone number.
"You can move back in a few days," he told her. "It looks as though the body's been there a while. Don't worry, you're not under arrest," he laughed.
Kitty and Bob glanced at each other. It felt disrespectful to joke. She packed some clothes, food, and her laptop into a holdall, then drove to the vacation park. The cabin they directed her to had heating and hot water, and she ran herself a hot bath that evening, the first she'd had in months. She was very shaken by the discovery and couldn't stop wondering who might be buried at Dimitri's cabin. Any explanation she could think of involved criminality. Did Dimitri have enemies? Is that why he lived in such a remote spot? Had he killed one of them in self-defense? Did his children know about the murder? Is that why they were estranged? Her phone lay on the table, and she wished she could just dial home and discuss it with Tom. She couldn't predict what he would say,
but knew his opinion would be worth listening to. She missed him terribly. One thing was for sure. Whoever buried a body at the cabin had not wanted the death to be discovered. And Kitty couldn't think of an innocent reason for that.
Chapter 49. Brooklyn, June 1934. When Dmitri wrote to tell his sisters that he was emigrating to America, Vera's husband Alex replied, asking if he would care to represent their carpet company in New York. They had just begun to export Ottoman rugs to America, but felt they were being exploited by the agent they used, and Alex would be delighted if Dmitri were to take over the role. He knew enough about the business from the 2 years he had spent working for them in Constantinople. Dmitri was not remotely interested in being a carpet import merchant, but he would need money to establish his family, so it seemed a useful temporary solution. He could not expect to make a living from journalism commissions on this new continent. His spoken English was more or less fluent now, but when he tried to write in English, the words would not flow. He could write business letters, but could not think imaginatively in any language but Russian. He and Rosa found an apartment in Brooklyn and enrolled the children, now aged 8 and 9, in school, while Dmitri set up an office for the carpet import business. His editor at Slovo had given him a letter of introduction to a New York publisher called Alfred A. Knopf, who was said to favour Russian and European literature, but he felt nervous about making an approach and kept putting it off.
"Dmitri, I did not fall in love with a carpet salesman. I fell in love with a brilliant writer. You must be true to yourself," Rosa coaxed. "Besides, I'm sure you will find that this Mr. Knopf has already heard of you and will be happy to meet."
Dmitri wasn't convinced.
"What will he say when I tell him I don't write in English?"
She shrugged.
"I don't know how publishing works, but if I were in his place, I would introduce you to a good translator."
Dmitri agonized over his letter to Alfred Knopf, then watched the mailbox for days until an envelope arrived with the Knopf logo on it.
"Look!"
he showed Rosa, unable to contain his excitement.
"They have a Russian wolfhound in their logo. It's like a sign. It's meant to be." "Open the letter, you dunderhead," she laughed. "I want to hear what it says."
"Mr. Knopf would be delighted to meet you at 3 p.m. on the 4th of October in his office in the Heckscher building at the corner of 57th Street and 5th Avenue," Dmitri read out loud, before grabbing Rosa for a hug and twirling her around. The Heckscher building was a modern skyscraper, almost like a cathedral with its pointed steeple on top, and the vast lobby decorated in Art Deco style. Dmitri gave his name to a receptionist and sat down feeling ridiculously nervous. What if he was told he would never be published in America, that his books were not good enough for their sophisticated readers, that he had been fooling himself to think he had any talent? He hardly had to wait 5 minutes before he was taken up in an elevator and shown into Mr. Knopf's office. A short, dark-haired man with a thick moustache and an extremely elegant suit came bounding across the room and enveloped him in a bear hug.
"I am Alfred," he grinned. "I am honored to meet you, sir. The Boot that Kicked is one of the bravest pieces of work I've ever read. Come, sit down. Can I offer you a drink? I have Russian vodka."
2 hours later, they were still talking about literature, history, politics, and the quirks of human nature, and although Dmitri was viewing the world through a vodka haze, he knew he had found a kindred spirit. They both liked Tolstoy and Gorky, Kuprin and Bunin. They both feared political extremes, whether to the right or the left. They both loved dogs.
"Whatever you decide to write next, I want to publish,"
Alfred said before Dmitri left.
"Let me know when you're ready to deliver, and I will find you the best translator in New York. And if you want an advance, you need only ask."
When Dmitri walked back into the evening sunlight, he felt a sensation he had not felt for a long time. Even though he was in a foreign country, it was like coming home. Dmitri marveled at Rosa's ability to become part of a social group in no time at all. He'd arrived back from the office to find the kitchen of their Brooklyn apartment full of women chatting while their children played in the communal yard outside.
"Where did you meet them all?"
he asked, after they had dispersed to their own apartments.
"Oh, in the grocery store, outside the school gates, you know."
She waved her hand airily. There were invitations to potluck suppers, Thanksgiving dinners, 4th of July celebrations, and summer cookouts, with the children always included. They weren't people Dmitri would normally have picked as friends, but they had enough in common to pass a pleasant evening. He often watched Rosa as she mingled at a social event and wondered at her ability to thrive in this new society yet still retain her sense of self. As she aged, she had never toned down her quirky style. If anything, her clothes had become more colourful in this new country, and she still had boyish short hair. Dmitri bought her a Singer sewing machine for her 40th birthday, and she was able to run up new frocks with lightning speed, often making garments for friends as well. He knew she missed her family, and that it had been a big wrench for her to cross the ocean to this new continent, but she never once complained. Nicholas and Marta were learning English faster than expected, and already spoke with American accents. They liked Superman and Flash Gordon comics, and each had their favourite baseball teams. All would have been well, Dmitri thought, except that he couldn't seem to get started on a new novel. The strong feelings that had inspired his earlier works just weren't there. Perhaps it was because he was content. Did he have to be miserable to write? In 1936, they moved to Albany, 130 miles north of New York City, where Dmitri was able to afford a 3-bedroom house with its own spacious garden, and within months, Rosa had made a brand new circle of friends. Her mother and sister arrived later that year, their immigration sponsored by Dmitri, and they moved into a house a few blocks down the same street. Nicholas and Marta were delighted and often ran to visit their grandmother for reasons Dmitri could never understand. He found her cold and unfriendly, but the children seemed to adore her. Sometimes Dmitri sat back and watched his children and wondered who they were. When they were little, it had been easy to see what motivated them because the emotions were on the surface. I want that toy and Nicholas is playing with it. I'm exhausted and really need to sleep, but I'm fighting it in the hope of getting another story. But now, as they entered their teens, they had become independent people who had learned to tell fibs, to have secrets, and to rebel against his authority.
Count yourself lucky. My father would have horsewhipped you for that, he told Nicholas, who was sobbing after receiving a clip round the ear for using coarse language.
Your father sounds like an asshole,
Nicholas shouted through his tears, and Dmitri couldn't help but admire his courage as he dealt out a punishment with the flat of his hand on bare legs. Rosa never hit them, but Dmitri knew he had to protect them from their own impulsiveness so they didn't get into trouble when they were older. He would never beat them with a whip, as his father had beaten him, but every child needed chastisement to keep them in line for their own sakes. Hitler's invasion of neighbouring countries and the outbreak of a new war only 21 years after the last tipped Dmitri suddenly and emphatically into depression. He couldn't believe that no lessons had been learned from the mass slaughter of the trenches. He couldn't understand why no assassin slipped through the cordons that surrounded the Führer to end the world's misery. He was anxious that he would no longer be able to support his family if naval blockades prevented the import of rugs. Suddenly, he could see no happiness in the life that had previously seemed so sunny. It was as if a shutter had come down that made everything dark and hopeless. Men were intrinsically evil the world over, from the Red Guards who had slaughtered the Romanovs to the brown-shirted Sturmabteilung who were shipping Jews and communists off to live in segregated ghettos. Rosa did her best to buoy him, remaining her cheerful self and asking nothing of him except his presence. He felt guilty that he had been such a poor choice of partner for her. He had spent their first 10 years hankering after another woman, and now he was nothing but a dead weight who found it hard to get out of bed in the morning. His adolescent children irritated and exhausted him. Marta was too interested in boys for a girl of her young age, and when he confined her to her room, she would climb out of the window. Nicholas never missed an opportunity to argue with him. Everything he said or did was wrong as far as his kids were concerned. Once America entered the war in both Europe and the Pacific, Dmitri sank to new depths of depression and stopped going to work. There seemed little point, since they had only occasional shipments to process. Alex continued to wire money, and that made Dmitri feel useless, a grown man who could not support his own family, but he could not afford to refuse it. He spent his days poring over the newspaper or listening to reports of the war on the radio, and often did not bother to change out of his pajamas. He was too old to fight, and of no further use to the world. Sometimes he took Tatiana's diary from the old brown suitcase where he still kept it, the one he had brought with him from Istanbul in 1922. When he read her descriptions of those last days in the Ipatiev house, it reminded him once again of his failure to save her, and made him feel more useless than ever. In the evenings, he drank until he passed out or made himself sick, then suffered the following morning. After a night out drinking in Berlin in the old days, he'd felt no more than a little stuffy-headed, but now hangovers wiped him out, a symptom of age. Up till then, Dmitri had caught the train to New York once or twice a year to have luncheon with Alfred Knopf. They were always convivial occasions at the city's great restaurants, the Waldorf, Barbetta, the exclusive 21 Club, and the meal would last from 12:30 through to 4 or 5 in the afternoon, by which time copious quantities of alcohol would have been consumed, and Dmitri would have to stagger back to Grand Central to catch the train home. Alfred's secretary would telephone 3 weeks in advance to arrange these luncheons, but when she rang in March 1942 to set a date, Dmitri told her he would not be able to make it.
"Mr. Knopf will be disappointed. What reason shall I give?"
"Just say that I can't condone the expenditure at a time when the world has gone mad. I'm sure he will understand." An hour later, when Alfred rang personally, Dmitri refused to take the call. Rosa closed the kitchen door, but he could hear her explaining that he was depressed about the war because it brought back too many memories from the past. She promised she would persuade him to telephone and set a new date for luncheon once he felt up to it. The following week, a van pulled up outside their house, and a delivery man knocked on their door.
"I have a gift from Mr. Alfred Knopf,"
Dmitri heard him say to Rosa. He got up to look out the window, and saw a Borzoi, a Russian wolfhound, just like the one on the Knopf logo. It was black with a white undercoat, and had the bounciness of a puppy. He felt like crying that the American publisher should care enough to send such a thoughtful gift. Rosa called for him, and he walked out to the porch and crouched to look at the pup. It was a beautiful animal, with intelligent eyes set in a small head, the exquisite curve of the haunches giving that famous silhouette, a coat that felt like silk. It was a boy, he noted. The pup licked his face, and he felt just a fraction of the ice within him begin to thaw.
"Malevich," he said. "I'll call him Malevich."
Dmitri was not the kind of man who had many friends. Malevich had been his closest friend during the last war, and Alfred was his closest during this. He wrote to express his undying gratitude, and promised he would be well enough for that luncheon soon. It was a turning point in more ways than one. Dmitri now had to go out twice a day to take Malevich for walks, and during those walks, he began to analyze his depression and attempt to understand it. Was it some kind of affliction, like measles, that clogged up brain function? Why did everything bad come to the forefront, so that activities he had previously enjoyed no longer held any pleasure? What was the weight that caused his feet to drag, that made it too much effort to brush his teeth or comb his hair? It was lack of hope, he realized. Somehow any hope for the future had been extinguished, but Malevich's uncomplicated enjoyment of life had brought back a flicker of light. He began to write a novel about a man going through a period of melancholy that tips over into full-blown depression and leads him to attempt suicide. Instead of a puppy, Dmitri's character was rescued by his secretary, a young woman of eccentric appearance and cheerful disposition, whose random thoughts on the universe were pivotal in adjusting the faulty wiring in his brain so that he could hope once more. He called the secretary in his novel Gloria, but in essence, she was a tribute to Rosa.
Chapter 50. Lake Akanabi, New York State, the 7th of October, 2016. 3 days after the discovery of the body, a detective came to visit Kitty at the vacation park. He was a tall man, with friendly eyes. She invited him to sit on the floral sofa, while she took a chair by the pine dining table. "I need to ask some questions about your great-grandfather," he began, taking out a notebook and rooting around in his briefcase for a pen. "Have you identified the body yet?" Kitty interrupted. He tapped his pen on the arm of the sofa before answering. She was a woman in her 70s when she died, and forensics can't find any signs of broken bones or bullet wounds. They think she could have been buried 40-odd years ago, although it's not an exact science. He paused to let that sink in. Now, your great-grandfather purchased the cabin in 1956, so it seems likely that he owned it at the time the body was buried.
Oh, God! So Dimitri could have been responsible. It was her worst fear.
We checked to see if it might be his partner, Rosa, your great-grandmother, but it seems she died in 1955 and is buried in a cemetery in Albany.
So he bought the cabin a year later. Perhaps he wanted to be alone.
She imagined him there, grief-stricken, introspective, living a quiet life. But the detective's next word shattered that vision. Have you ever heard of a woman called Irina Markova?
Kitty nodded. She was the translator of Dimitri's later novels. He thanks her in the acknowledgements.
We've checked Dimitri's bank records, and it seems he made monthly payments to Irina Markova from 1948 through to 1975. Quite substantial amounts. You never heard anything about her? Perhaps from your mother or grandmother?
Kitty shook her head, baffled. Maybe she did other translation work for him, or perhaps she acted as his secretary.
We thought of that. We checked the records of the carpet import business where Dmitry Yakovlevich worked on his arrival in the United States, but there was no employee of that name.
Kitty was amazed. He worked in a carpet import business. I never knew that.
He retired from carpets in 1951, on his 60th birthday. By that time, he was relatively wealthy because the movie adaptation of his novel, In the Pale Light of Dawn, had come out, and he owned a share of the box office. The receipts from that and the follow-up, Toward the Sunset, kept him comfortably for the rest of his life.
Kitty was gobsmacked. Call herself a journalist. She'd been trying to find out about Dimitri all summer and hadn't even turned up the fact that two of his novels had been filmed. It made her all the more astonished that no one had told her about him when she was growing up. She'd often sat down to watch old movies on Saturday evenings with her mum, dad, and Grandma Marta. Why had none of them mentioned the family connection to movies?
I see this comes as a surprise, the detective continued. So you probably won't be able to help us fill in any more of Irina Markova's life story. We know she came to the U.S. from Czechoslovakia in 1948 and set up home in Albany, but we have no record of her death in this country. We got in touch with her stepdaughter, Hannah Markova, in a place called Brno.
He pronounced it Brno.
We tracked her down using the address on Irina's immigration papers, but she says they didn't hear from her after 1948.
Do you think it might be Irina Markova who was buried at my cabin? It was horrible to think of the body as a person with a name, an identity, someone with living relatives who would be upset to hear of her death.
It's only a possibility, the detective said. We may be able to make an identification from dental records, or if we find a blood relative who can give a DNA match. But it might be someone else entirely. Perhaps it's a stranger buried there without your great-grandfather's knowledge, and we may never identify her.
Kitty shook her head in astonishment. I'm sorry I can't be of more help, but it seems you know more about my family than I do. Dimitri had lost touch with his daughter Marta when he died, and I have no idea why.
I can't help you there. He consulted his notes. Dimitri's son, Nicholas, died at the age of 45 of cirrhosis of the liver. Marta moved to England in 1958, and we don't know what she did after that.
Cirrhosis? Kitty was alarmed. So he was an alcoholic?
Not necessarily, but I believe that's the most common cause.
Oh, Christ, that means I have a gene for alcoholism, Kitty realized. She knew she'd been drinking far too much that summer. She'd have to rein it in.
Anyway, you're free to move back into your cabin now, the detective said. He stood up and handed her a card. Get in touch if you think of anything that might be pertinent.
Before you go, would it be possible to put me in touch with Hannah Markova? I'd really like to speak to her.
He gave her a sharp look.
I don't think that would be right, in the circumstances.